Chapter 26. The King of Kings and the African Sun. I went to Christ the King. Peter Hockaday had taken a job researching the family history of the elderly Reverend Zedobiah Darwin, who was anxious to prove that he was not even remotely related to the infamous Charles. For a small monthly stipend, Peter would go to the vicar's house in Byng Place and trawl through an enormous, disorganized collection of papers, many of which had no bearing on the gentleman's ancestry at all, but Zedobiah was adamant that they had to be checked and filed before he would be satisfied. The Reverend Darwin always attended an afternoon liturgy at the Church of Christ the King, a few dozen yards away, and Peter would escort him there and walk briskly round the square for 20 minutes before collecting him. For once my timing was perfect, and I was just in time to witness Peter handing his enfeebled charge over to a verger before making off. Geraldine's brother was a tall man, and his military training showed in his erect gait, and the way he carried his cane tucked under his arm as a swagger stick. "Good afternoon, Miss Middleton." He lifted his hat. "Are you attending the service?" "I do not need to go in there to find God," I said, and he let his hat drop back. "You are lucky to find him at all," he told me. "I lost him under the African sun, and I have never quite found him again." That was the first time I had known Peter Hockaday to refer even obliquely to his time in the Sudan. I knew from Geraldine that he had been present at the Battle of El Obeid, a terrible slaughter with 8,000 Egyptian troops killed by the Mahdists and only a handful of their British officers surviving. He was lucky to escape with only part of his left earlobe missing. "Perhaps he will find you again one day," I suggested. Peter Hockaday did not look convinced. "But I must not talk like this on hallowed ground." He tried to look abashed. "Will you take a short walk with me?"
"It is you I have come to see, Mr. Hockaday." I took his proffered arm. "I am worried about your sister."
"You are right to be."
He paused to tickle a stray dog's ear.
"Oh, Miss Middleton."
"Please call me March," I urged. "It saves 3 syllables.
"If you will do the same," he told me, and became flustered. "I mean, call me Peter, of course."
I laughed and then remembered. "You were about to say something."
"Only that I wish you had known Geraldine before all this."
We turned left into Gordon Square, a pleasant rectangle of greenery surrounded by superior soot-dabbled houses, the dog ambling at Peter's heel.
"She was so alive," he continued. "Her eyes, I cannot tell you, March. If they could have been mounted, they would have graced the crown jewels."
"Oh!" Peter stopped, and his new friend stopped too, sitting obediently at his feet.
"I hope you do not think I was making fun of Mr. Grice's eye."
"I shall not mention it to him," I vowed, and we set off again. Peter had long strides, and though he tried to accommodate his pace to mine, I found myself almost breaking into an intermittent run.
"I hope you do not mind me saying that Geraldine does not like your guardian," he told me, as we skirted a group of boys kicking a rag ball. "And if truth be told..."
"Neither do you," I broke in. "Not many people do." Peter hesitated.
"Would it be impertinent to ask?"
"When I was imprisoned, Mr. Grice came to see me."
"I should hope so." He patted the dog.
"He was my one comfort," I said. "I know that is difficult to believe."
Peter squeezed my arm with his. "He does not seem the most sympathetic of men."
"He asked me to marry him." I glanced up and saw that my companion was shocked. But that was only so he could control my money. I shut my mouth. It had not been exactly like that, had it?
"Is he making any progress on my sister's case?" Peter asked.
"Very little." I reached towards the dog, but it shied away. "I did make an offer to Geraldine to refund your money if she wanted us to drop our investigations."
Peter crushed my arm against him. "You will not abandon her. You cannot."
"I do not know what else to do," I confessed.
"And Mr. Grice, has he given up?"
We stepped onto the road to get round an artist, chalking a good likeness of Lord Nelson on the pavement. "Mr. Grice never gives up," I asserted, though I sometimes believed he had given up on me. We turned right, along the short side of the not-very-square square. "I shall give him a week," Peter declared. A hurdy-gurdy man was jigging wildly as he cranked his instrument. Some of the strings were broken, I noticed, but he still managed to produce such an ear-splitting, wailing noise that the dog darted in front of Peter, hackles raised, ready to protect its new master. "And then you will want your money back," I clarified. Peter puffed. "I shall have no use for money then, and neither shall the man who hurt my sister." The dog jumped backwards, nearly tripping us both over it. "What will you do?" I asked in alarm. "I think you can guess."
"Stop! Thief!"
We turned to see who was yelling.
"Those two!"
An elderly man in a tattered naval uniform bawled from across the road.
"They be stealing my barker!"
The dog, on hearing his true master's voice, cowered and tried to hide behind my skirts. But the old seaman came rolling over, miraculously avoiding being run over by a phaeton weaving round a covered cart.
"I assure you,"
Peter began, but the man was reeling a length of rope out of his pocket and looping it around the dog's neck. The dog crouched. "How do I know it is yours?" I demanded.
"Well, it ain't yours,"
he replied, and dragged the dog away, its claws trying desperately to anchor it to the spot.
"You are choking it,"
I protested, but the dog gave up the fight and slunk miserably beside him. I knew this was a trick to make us buy the animal, but neither of us could adopt a dog.
"You will not take the law into your own hands?" I asked anxiously, but Peter did not reply at once.
A cat ran by with a flapping grey pigeon in its mouth, and a clock bell sounded far away.
"Geraldine left it in the hands of the police, and I placed it in Mr. Grice's."
His clear blue eyes darted away from me.
"And what good has it done her, March? If we cannot have justice, we shall have revenge."
"I may have a better plan."
I saw the pigeon's beak open and close in a silent plea for the mercy it would not receive. He checked his half-hunter.
"I am sorry. I must return to my employer, but can I meet you to discuss it?"
"Do you know where the Empress Cafe is? Tomorrow at 10?
"I shall be there. Will you be all right if I leave you here?"
"I came alone,"
I reminded him, and Peter Hockaday inclined his head. I stood for a minute, watching him march away, a good head above the crowd, so tall and strong that I was frightened for him.